That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Now, you want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
I know newspapers backward, forward, and sideways. I can write them, edit them, print them, wrap them, and sell them.
Don't need anybody right now.
I can handle big news and little news. And if there's no news, I'll go out and bite a dog.
It is the Week in Review, the dog biting edition. I'm Steve Scher, or maybe it's the everybody's a little sick edition. Eli's a little sick. That's what happens when you write for the Stranger. Not really, but I'm trying to make a transition. And Berger's a little
the hot
sick.
House of communicable illness.
That's right. That's right. At Crosscut, the Crosscut is you get a little bit of a flu, but Skip's all warm in his Seahawks scarf. Johnny Balter, are you at all?
I'm not ill, but
weather?
Hanging around you three doesn't look good, does
it? I'm not ill. I'm raring to go. It's good to see you all again. I guess this is really the Seahawks edition of the Week in Review, because has there been anything else spoken about in America or the world today this week?
Absolutely not.
And if so, who cares?
I don't know. All right, so let's start with that. This story has been. I was serious when I said I think I was watching the E! Network one time, and it was when Richard Sherman came out and he was dressed in that excellent suit.
Oh,
he looked really good. And the E! Network was talking about his suit and also the things he said. But they were mostly focusing on the suit and the things
That's
he said.
That's TV for you.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, let's start with that. Here, let me ask you some questions. But here's Richard Sherman talking on Wednesday about some of the names he's been called.
The only reason it bothers me is because it seems like it's the accepted way of calling somebody the N-word nowadays. You know, it's like everybody else said the N-word, and then they say thug, and they're like, oh, that's fine. And that's where it's kind of, you know, it kind of takes me aback, and it's kind of disappointing because they know.
That's been the conversation this week, and I wonder how you guys have taken this conversation. What did you think about the language they used and the back and forth that it engendered?
Well, I've had a couple moments with it, because when he said it on the television, when he said all that competitive sort of mean stuff, I wasn't glad to see that. And I remember the bewildered look of the reporter who said, now back to you. In other words, get this interview out of here, because I don't know what's going to happen next. But as the week has unfolded, I have to say I really, really like Richard Sherman. And I like the things he's said and the way he sort of laughed at himself. He had a very interesting comment where he described a hockey game. I'm sorry, I forget which two teams, where the game began. Nobody looked at the puck. They just started fighting. And then Richard Sherman said, and I'm the thug, which was great. This is a really thoughtful guy, not necessarily in the heat of the moment, a little less thoughtful there, but a really smart guy. Went to Stanford. I heard he had a 3.9 or something, but as the way he's been sort of learning from, apologizing, I've found him to be fascinating.
All right, speaking of maybe not in the heat of the moment, this is part of what he said right at the end of the game there.
Richard, let me ask you, the final play, take me through it.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a sorry receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get. Don't you ever talk about me.
You know, you look back on it, and then you see that face plant that Crabtree gave him at that time. Sorry, receiver. And then it explodes into a rant, and then it's a discussion about he's a thug.
But, you know, what I like about him is how honest he is. I mean, he's got an unfiltered quality to him. So you're hearing in that moment the kind of post-game, post-huge win for the Seahawks, post-huge play for Richard Sherman, adrenaline high. These guys get out there, and they are obviously into what they're doing, and it's obviously a huge rush for them. And so you're hearing some of that, and then you're also hearing the result of what Richard Sherman described as an exchange on the field, where either Crabtree, I don't know, I'm now out of beyond my knowledge of football names, but whoever, you know,
you work for the Stranger, man.
Richard Sherman extended his hand or tried to, you know, go up to the guy, and the guy was not friendly to him. So Richard Sherman was upset on top of it all. What's ugly is the way that people responded online. And most of this, at least as far as I've seen, is online, on Twitter, in comments. And so there's another kind of unfortunate element to it where a lot of this comes out anonymously. You know, people who are not attaching their names or faces to very racist statements that they are making in reaction to this rant, which is pretty cowardly, but also reveals, you know, maybe what people are actually thinking and reminds us again how far the country has to go in terms of its just kind of gut reactions to images and actions that I think, you know, unfortunately, and a lot of people have said this, large black man yelling on TV just by itself is enough to trigger certain reactions in some people who aren't processing it in a very sophisticated way.
Yeah, I think that was sort of the most telling thing, wasn't it, Knute, that you can't be, not in America, you can't still be doing that. You can't be yelling. You can't be showing your emotions. Something Barack Obama knows a little bit about too, right?
Well, yeah, and there have been a lot of people questioning whether this would have been a controversy if Richard Sherman had been a white football player, what the racial dimension is. I mean, I think Seattle's response to it's fantastic. Richard Sherman jersey sales are going off the charts. People who weren't necessarily that into football and maybe didn't know that much about Richard Sherman, a lot of people have rallied to him, partly because of the response of the racists online, partly because it's given him a chance in the aftermath both to apologize in a very intelligent way. And I agree with Eli. He didn't say, "I misspoke." He didn't say, "I wish I could take it back." He said, you know, he said he wished he'd handled it better and that he really regretted and apologized on behalf, you know, that he was taking the attention away from the incredible game his teammates had.
Yeah.
So he owned up to what he did. He said, look, I play a barbaric sport and I have to be a barbarian when I'm playing that sport. And I have an on-off switch and that I switch on that part of me that I need to switch on to play at the level I play. And normally when you're in that mode, somebody's not sticking a microphone in your face. And so I think everybody got, if nothing else, people got a chance to see that kind of raw intensity that can kind of disappear when you're sitting up in the stands. And it's also not like, you know, Richard Sherman, I mean, the whole thug meme, you know, I mean, part of it is, you know, relating to his background coming from Compton and the sort of, oh, he's just another gangster, that kind of thing. But he's the least thuggish player in many respects. I mean, he's a physical player, but he's not the kind of guy who's throwing cheap hits on people and, you know, doing like your hockey guys, you know, going out there just to start a fight.
By the way, that was the Flames Canuck line brawl on Saturday. Just on that meme, this was Sherman.
I fought that my whole life, just coming from where I'm coming from. You know, just because you hear Compton, you hear Watts, you hear cities like that, you just think thug. He's a gangster. He's this, that, and the other. And then you hear Stanford, and they're like, oh, man, that doesn't even make sense. That's an oxymoron. And you fight it for so long, and to have it, you know, come back up and people start to use it again is really, it's frustrating.
The other thing he said was the only reason it bothers me because it seems like it's the accepted way of calling somebody the N-word nowadays because they know. And that, of course, was debated for the rest of the week, too. Are those equivalent in the way people are using the language?
Well, I don't honestly know if they're equivalent, but what I also noticed about all of this was that, you know, these Super Bowls, when they have 2 weeks to go and the media has to come up with themes, and you alluded to this in your tease of the show, they need a storyline, they need a narrative. And so now all of a sudden it's good versus evil. And guess what, Seattle? We're the evil ones. And so there was this column in the LA Times that was pretty interesting, and it kept pitting, you know, good versus evil, John Elway versus Paul Allen, just all these comparisons. And somehow this, so now when you ask America, I've seen polls on this, who are you rooting for? They're rooting for good. That would be Denver versus us because we're evil. So it's I kept wondering, how are they going to come up with enough stories to sustain us for two weeks? So this is one way.
Dave Craig could come out and shake hands with John Elway before the game starts, because that was an old rivalry, right?
Yeah.
Seahawks and the Broncos. You don't pay attention that much to football. You're kind of like me, right? I don't pay attention that much to football either.
But I have planted my feet firmly on the bandwagon. I watched the last two games with a group of guys who knit while they're watching football. So,
thank goodness.
I've watched, you know, I've tried to pick up what I could. I was thinking on this point of thuggishness. I mean, first of all, on the question of what word is equal to what word, I don't know that any of us at this table, and I don't know that most of the people getting all hot and bothered about this really have are speaking from a position of knowledge. And mm-hmm. if this is Richard Sherman's experience and perception, we should listen to his experience and perception. It might teach us something. But also on this question of thuggishness, you know, not being a regular football watcher, who is more thuggish? The guy who is doing this sport that he loves at a level that is extremely intense and that he's, you know, extremely good at and gives us what we want, the win, or the people, the viewers who sit there and watch this sport where, you know, at one point in that same game, the number of times that they replayed the knee injury or leg injury for the 49ers player who went down right near the end zone, and that's the end of the words that I know how to use to describe what happened, but
they threw food too. Some of the seats.
But I mean, yeah. Football is about it seems in some respect fans taking pleasure out of the pain that men inflict on each other, and so there's a barbaricness and a thuggishness to the joy of watching the sport,
like bullfights and gladiators and stuff like that.
Bullfights. That was Joni Balter, by the way, who is a news analyst and a contributor to Bloomberg View. And that was Eli Sanders, who writes for The Stranger, assistant editor, and Knut Berger, who writes at Crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine, author of Pugetopolis. And I have a question, a sort of a broader question. Our colleague, Bill Radke, had his own rant that was on the air in the newsroom and then on the air on the record. And his argument was, basically, why do you care? Why do you even care about the Seahawks? They're not really our team. This is one thing he said. Do the Seahawks seem in any way Seattle-ish to you? Russell Wilson is overtly, devoutly Christian and good for him, but Seattle is not. New Yorkers are known for being loud. Seattle is loud only when we go to a game and scream exactly like every other fan in America. We're sitting in a field called CenturyLink, based in Louisiana, that was architecturally designed to make ordinary screaming really loud. Maybe you root for the Seahawks out of loyalty. Did you know there was once a team called the Miami Seahawks that moved to Baltimore before Baltimore moved to Indianapolis? Like the Sonics have shown you what loyalty means to sports teams. Skip, why do you have the Seahawks scarf around your around your neck? When they're just mercenaries traveling from one city to the next.
Yeah, well, you can. I guess you can deconstruct just about. You know, anything. I mean, are the Seahawks, you know, really all that different from, you know, Amazon, a bunch of guys from out of town who come to Seattle and figure out how to make money? I mean, you know, you could parse anything that way. Sports, whether you like it or hate it, you know, sports has this quality of, you know, particularly fathers and sons, but families kind of growing up, you pass on these loyalties from one generation to another. And there is a way, I think, I disagree with Bill completely on his party pooper editorial. and even Bill, I think, disagrees with himself because he gave a little commentary on KCTS the same week where he was rooting for the Seahawks and said, go Seahawks. So, he's of two minds, I think. A lot of people, I think, see the Seahawks, especially now, as a kind of representative of the city, in that we're underestimated, we're the underdog, we're geographically remote. Those guys on the East Coast don't like us and don't understand us. That's very much a part of Seattle psychology, is wanting to have a kind of acknowledgement and respect and not quite getting it. And there's a way now that the Seahawks embody that aspiration, to be noticed, to be finally hit the big time. And, you know, we've been trying for an awful long time, knocking at those doors, not very successfully in the sports area. But that's, I think it does reflect a certain kind of civic passion.
And that's what it's all about. Listen, it's the middle to the end of January. It couldn't be duller around here, but the city is jazzed because it has this common sense of excitement about this team. So let it rip, you know.
You agree too?
Yes, and I've been thinking while Joni and Skip were talking about the question of ranting and is ranting appropriate. And I was thinking, what is the internet for? Everyone is ranting now, and Richard Sherman is essentially a great blogger in a way. And so you could make an argument about, you know, the kind of pervasiveness of everyone ranting and responding to other people's rants is. Doesn't take us anywhere that illuminating, and it would be nice to have more of a space for a longer, thoughtful conversation. Great. But the sideline of a football field is not necessarily the place where you want to try to enforce that the most. And so, again, I just think it leads back to a kind of cultural hypocrisy.
Hmm. You know, the Grammys are this weekend. Macklemore and Lewis are nominated for Grammys. Isn't it a similar thing? Aren't we rooting for the hometown guys to win a Grammy for their great music in the same way that we root for the Seahawks?
Yes, indeed. And that particular individual, Macklemore, actually revved up the crowd, even though if you were watching the game from Seattle anyway, you couldn't really see much of the performance. But from people who were there said that, you know, the songs that he sang, Can't Hold Us, you know, actually really just revved up the crowd even more, and maybe the team, for all we know. I'm sure they heard some of it.
Dovetail with what you were talking about, too. Can't Hold Us, all the themes. Dovetail the same thing you're talking about, Knute, that we...
Yeah, and I think this what will motivate the Seahawks, and already has motivated them this week, the storyline, is not white hat, black hat, because I don't think we see ourselves as black hats. I don't even think the rest of the country sees us as black hats. But we do see ourselves as underdogs. And this team gets motivated by that. We get motivated by that. And
Richard Sherman gets motivated by that.
Richard Sherman sure gets motivated by that. And I think that will be the energy that is you know, flowing toward our glorious Super Bowl performance.
All right. Well, we'll come back to this towards the end of the hour. We'll take a break. This is the Week in Review with Knute Berger, with Eli Sanders, with Joni Balter. I'm Steve Scher on KUOW.
Richard, let me ask you the final play. Take me through it.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a sorry receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get. Don't you ever talk about me.
The two teams going to the Super Bowl, Seattle and Denver, come from the two states that just legalized recreational marijuana. In unrelated news, the city of Cleveland just legalized pot, crack, heroin, crystal meth, and huffing paint. I'm Peter Sagal. You really don't have to work that hard to win on our show. Wait, don't tell me. The news quiz from NPR.
That's 24 hours from now, tomorrow at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. A little bit less than 24 hours from now. It's 10:24. At the moment. 44 degrees in Seattle, expecting lots of sun today and a high of 51.
Support for KUOW comes from Whitefish Mountain Resort, celebrating 65 years of skiing and snowboarding on 3,000 acres of bowls, steeps, and glades in Whitefish, Montana. Direct flights and train service from Seattle daily. More information at skiwhitefish.com.
It's the Week in Review from KUOW. I'm Steve Scher, Knute Berger, author of Pugetopolis and other books, Eli Sanders, Pulitzer Prize winner, assistant editor of The Stranger, Joni Balter, news analyst. Good to be back with you all.
We missed you, Steve.
I missed you.
You didn't miss us as much as we did.
Oh, that's such a heartfelt expression.
It was so
longing
not
to be back with us.
I thought about you once or twice. Not.
I missed you guys. I was following the news, thinking about what you were talking about, you guys and Marcy. And one of the things I was thinking about was the world's largest drill still stuck, and nobody knows why. And Danny Westney of the Seattle Times his column. Something sure seems broken with the Bertha mega project. Something more than the tunneling machine itself. And what his argument is that we don't really still know what's going on, and maybe they're not telling us, or maybe they don't know.
Well, what he was describing, I thought in pretty good detail, was the difference between the tweets that were coming from allegedly Bertha herself, you know, and sort of some of
the— I might question that in the first
some
question.
Of the—
That machine—
Cannot.
Has no thumbs.
Has no thumbs. But that in contrast, in other words, the PR machine, in contrast with what later came out about how Department of Transportation officials have been worried about Bertha since she first started chewing mud.
Yeah.
You solved the mystery. It's the thumbs of the machine that are dragging against the sides of the hole, slowing it down.
Some folks are going to go down into the tunnel today, not to the head of it, but some reporters are going to go down into the tunnel and get more information. But we still don't really know everything that's keeping it stuck, right?
Yeah, I mean, Danny did a great job in that column of pointing out that there were things that WSDOT knew that it didn't tell us and let us believe that this pipe was stopping Bertha when, in fact, they knew the pipe had moved beyond. They'd run Bertha for several days beyond when they hit the pipe. And so one thing was they knew that there was probably some other factor slowing it down, but they didn't talk about that. And then when they finally did talk about it, they're, you know, conducting this investigation. They found this week, they did find a large boulder, chunk of concrete. They found some additional piping debris and that kind of thing. So they have to figure out how to remove those things from the cutting face. And then they have to finish inspecting. But the WSDOT has continued to suggest that they don't think the debris that Bertha's run into is the whole problem, that there's something else. There's something wrong with the machine. There's something about the soil conditions, some other factor that they need to figure out. And this is where you begin to hear, you know, this distancing between the tunnel company and the contractor and WSDOT in terms of sort of tiptoeing around the idea that maybe there'd be a lawsuit or liability or whatever, all of which suggests that not that the problem isn't solvable, but that there may be some big expenses kicking in at some point.
Well, you and your colleague at Crosscut, Matt Fixie Fairkirk, he had a scenario that the maybe it's the design, a bearing surprise, but maybe even bigger, that the design of the thing in trying to accomplish this drilling might just be very, very difficult, which was the critique that was laid on this project from the get-go.
Well, Matt has been talking to tunnel experts about problems with tunneling. And one of the problems, one of the disputes about Bertha was whether it was the right kind of machine. There are a couple of different machines. One is apparently a little more effective at getting through sloppy ground.
That's what we have.
And no, we have the other. We have Bertha. There's a machine apparently that's—
No, I mean our ground
a little
is,
bit.
Our ground is sloppy.
Yes, the ground is sloppy, and perhaps sloppier than was anticipated. So I mean they're making discoveries as they go along. But one thing he was saying was that in many of these cases, almost all cases where you have trouble with the boring machines, is it tends to be they're being pushed beyond capacity, either because of the way they were designed or the way they're being worked.
Well, we know a couple things. We know that Bertha chewed a pipe, ate a rock, and ran into some other stuff that wasn't too pleasant. And pretty soon, and this is what this is sort of striking to me, is how fast everybody started in their litigious kind of speak. You know, and there, so that seemed to be also what was breaking down. Bertha's stuck underground and above ground. Everybody's sort of this relationship, which kind of just began. It's a little early. And now folks are saying, well, you know, we didn't really think it was going to be so good from the beginning. And, you know, you didn't hire the right folks. And, you know, just sort of chilling up here.
You're talking about beyond capacity. I was struck by some of the lack of capacities that the machine had. It chewed through this pipe, and the tangled pipe got stuck in its maw, and they've been cleaning, you know, pipe out of the rotor blades. But it also, as Joni put it, swallowed this boulder. So there's a boulder sitting inside Bertha somewhere. and
delicious.
Other machines have the capacity to digest it, to carry forward Joni's analogy, to crush it.
Sorry, it was
they
bad.
They come equipped with boulder crushers.
Yeah.
And this machine, which everyone knew was tunneling through glacial remains, which would include boulders moved around during the last ice age, is not equipped to crush any boulders that it swallows. And so the boulder that's sitting inside Bertha, they're going to have to jackhammer into bits. They actually have to go in there and import a boulder crusher with, you know, via a human into the machine, which seems like a design flaw.
Yeah, well, as I understand it, Bertha can chew up boulders of a certain size if the ground is solid enough that the boulder doesn't shift. In other words, while it's stuck in place and it holds still, it can grind it. But if it's in wet ground, as it is, and it shifts, it's resist. You know, it can't. The cutting machine can't get purchase on it, and therefore it creates a blocking hazard or something like that.
This is like a Reader's Digest thing that says, I am Bertha's stomach, you know, and just goes on from there.
I haven't heard of late conversations from the state or from city officials about who's going to pay if these costs go beyond the contingencies.
Well,
but I heard some state legislatures starting to sound a little...
Well, remember that language we've talked about a couple times here. Remember when the original tunneling language was developed, there was this language put in that said any costs that exceed $2.8 billion, I think was the number, shall be borne by Seattle area property owners who benefit from the project. Like, who's that? How in the heck would you assign those costs?
Who helped put that language into that?
I'm trying to remember. I think maybe did the speaker put those in there?
Yeah,
I think he might have.
He worked with Ed Murray and others come up with language that would be acceptable.
And wasn't it to win over legislators from the rest of the state who never liked doing anything for Seattle, even though one of the other rationales for this was that this tunnel benefits the entire state?
Right. And at this point, that language is still there, but we've had assurances from Seattle voters that assurances that it's not
enforceable.
And we've also had... Judy Cliburn on the Transportation Committee say that that would not be how it went. But, you know, that's just her opinion.
Of course, at this point, we don't know what this is costing or what it means for the project in the long term because they don't know.
Right.
Well, it's an interesting and ongoing situation. All right. Well, here's the other story that broke this week that was interesting was the Eastside Catholic president resigned. She was the president of the school that they got rid of their vice principal because he had married his partner, a gay man. Here's a conversation we had with one of the alum who were arguing that there had to be some changes at the school.
There's a little more compassionate understanding within our ranks in the Catholic Church, so we feel that homosexuality can still be part of God's plan, and you know, with that being the case, that these incredible educators like Mark Zamuda can fit into the fold at Catholic schools, that your sexuality shouldn't define you within the church.
Well, that was Eastside Catholic alumnus Corey Sinzer. He was talking to Ross Reynolds on Wednesday about the resignation of the school's principal, Sister Mary Tracy. Where do you make of this story at this point as it's evolving? Because this story has been picked up. New York Times has had this story.
Front page of the New York Times.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is just an interesting collision between, you know, public attitudes and certainly attitudes of young people, like the students at this school, have changed. And the Catholic institution hasn't changed quickly enough to kind of match that. So you can't help but wonder or maybe hope that a new person will come in and hire Mark Zamuda back.
I agree. Another sign of the church being out of sync with the values of a lot of American Catholics, and then particularly the generational divide, because this is very strongly coming up from younger Catholics who are resisting what the hierarchy of the church would like to do in cases like this. And it's very exciting to watch. I mean, the Catholic Church, I'm not Catholic, so I don't know about this from personal experience, but from the outside, it seems to be a very top-down organization. Very invested in its hierarchy. And so to see a grassroots push back against what that hierarchy is trying to enforce is really interesting and hopefully leads somewhere good beyond just the change in principles.
Part of the pushback we've seen around the world, really. Of course, we do have somebody at the top who's also challenging the structure and the hierarchy.
Yeah, you're sort of getting change at both ends because you have the Pope suggesting that a more tolerant attitude, a more, you know, not putting this sort of on the front burner and making it a cause on the one end. And then you have to be proud of the students. I mean, it really came about as a result of the publicity and whatnot as students protesting and going that next thing suggests at one level they're being well served by their educational institution in order to be able to stand up and tell authority you're wrong.
And they use the words of the new Pope to make their argument. There were signs that said what Pope Francis had said, "Who am I to judge?" They had those signs to make their case.
So when the president of Eastside Catholic, Sister Mary Tracy, so when she resigned this week in December, she fired the school's gay vice principal, Mark Zamuda. Zamuda responded to her resignation on King 5.
I do think that as an administrator there, I do make a difference. And if given the opportunity, I would love to go back and work there and continue to, you know, push the school in the right direction and hopefully move it forward.
It's interesting to hear this sort of this scenario being sketched out where he may come back and the students may have had a victory in their protest, and then the school will have to acknowledge some change.
I mean, it almost sounds like that could happen. That's what I would be hoping for.
It's also such an interesting contrast to me. In the gay community, you run into a lot of Catholic homosexuals who have left the church because they just can't really abide the feeling that the church expresses towards their lifestyle. Even the way it's being expressed right now at Eastside Catholic is kind of, it's pretty close to hate the sin, love the sinner, you know? And
not by the students, but by the people in positions of authority.
Right. And so there are a lot of people who just leave. They don't want to be any part of that. And then with Mark Zamuda, you're seeing another approach, which is to push as hard as they can within the system. If the system expels them because of this, well, then the system makes an example of itself, and maybe it will then correct itself and bring him back into the fold. But it's just a very interesting difference in disposition. I think another person who has felt more like working within a system that he finds somewhat flawed on this issue is Ed Murray. We talked about this last week, but we have a great example in Seattle of a gay Catholic who has stayed with the church, even though it has not stayed with him exactly on this issue, and still stays with the church and hopes for it to change.
And what's the distance between Eastside Catholic and, you know, City Hall? You know, physical distance and then cultural difference, because Ed Murray, if I'm not mistaken, is the nation's first gay married mayor.
Oh, is that right?
I think so.
All right. We're talking with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger on the Week in Review from KUOW. You know there will be no Week in Review extra on the record, but instead you'll get this entire hour. So if you miss part of it, it'll be on at 1 o'clock this afternoon as well. And you can always find us as a podcast. Go to KUOW.org and find the podcast page, and you can subscribe to this podcast as well. Coming up, we'll talk about Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers. She's delivering the Republican response to the State of the Union. We'll talk about Seattle Police Department, POT, and we'll come back and talk a little more about the Seahawks. This is KUOW.
KUOW and Seattle's Chinatown International District present Seattle's Lunar New Year Festival, featuring a neighborhood food walk, lion and dragon dances, arts and crafts, and much more, February 1st from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. in and around Hinghe Park. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
Forty-five degrees in Seattle with sun, and the sun is going to stick with us all day. We'll reach a high of about 41 this afternoon. Overnight, expect a mostly clear sky, a low of 37, and then tomorrow, some morning clouds and fog, then mostly sunny again with a high of 49. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:41.
This is the Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. So did this announcement just come out in the last few minutes? Oh, it came out yesterday?
Yesterday, yes. That that Attorney General Eric Holder has, and this has been anticipated for many months here, that something would happen, that some regulatory change would occur, because as you may know, that some of the pot businesses were going to have to be cash only until a fix was made, because banks are very reluctant to lend to pot businesses because they can then be accused of money laundering. But
because it's only legal in two states.
Because it's only legal in two states, and there's federal banking rules and all of that good stuff. But what has apparently the federal government is going to announce a fix, and banks will be able to provide banking services to the various pot businesses in our state.
You're the pot expert, because that's some of what you had been written now and have been writing now in your Bloomberg.
In my Bloomberg debut show.
Debut, yeah. How do you feel about being the pot expert?
I think it's hilarious because I didn't know very much about it when I started, so it's great. I went to pot school to learn how to do this.
Pot school?
Yes.
No,
seriously. What I mean is you're taking it wrong because you're you. But what I did was I just had to learn about how this very complicated industry would be set up.
Oh, I see. I thought somebody was interesting. Here's a pipe. This is a bud.
I knew you
were getting a lot of good publicity.
I knew you were thinking that.
Because the two teams that are in the Super Bowl are from the pot states.
So this is the pot bowl.
What does that say? The Super Bowl, as people.
What time is the game?
It's
3:30. So 4:20 in the middle of the game, people will stand up and make their statement. What I know that won't really happen, but I thought it was interesting. We also saw that the Attorney General has said local governments can ban sales of pot if they want to in Washington State. And that was a question that was in the. People were questioning that in the initiative, whether that
it's
was
very
the
controversial.
Case or not.
And, you know, in Colorado, you know, many communities there, either counties or cities or towns, have also enacted either bans or moratoriums. So there's a lot of opting in and out on this. A lot of the sort of pot industry here was surprised that the Attorney General said that. But apparently they missed a sentence that they needed to have that would specifically state that the new law, Initiative 502, supersedes local law, and they didn't have that sentence in there. I mean, this will end up in court, I imagine.
I'm not even clear on whether they can insert in an initiative language that overrules state zoning law. That probably would have ended up in court also, I would guess, but I don't know the ins and outs of that law. I'm interested in the proposals for new laws that are now being put forward in the state legislature to create disincentives for people to not have pot stores in their municipalities.
Wait, help me with that, because there was a double negative in that sentence. Disincentives to not have pot stores?
Yeah, that is a big double negative. I'll tell it this way. We talked about this last week. There's a Republican representative or legislator who is putting forward a proposal that says, well, if you have pot stores operating in your city, then you are going to get a certain percentage of the revenue from those pot stores back directly into your city. And if you don't have pot stores in your city, if you outlaw them through zoning action or whatever, say goodbye to that money, that certain percentage of money that would come in from the revenue.
Oh, interesting. A hammer to get you to participate. Seattle Times in an editorial said those cities like Yakima are wrongheaded to ban pot sales in their bounds.
Yeah, the question is who gets to decide. You know, part of it is, I mean, cities have the right to zone and create certain restrictions. One of the questions is whether you can just ban it altogether. I mean, with alcohol, that happened. There were dry towns, dry counties, you know, that kind of thing. Some states were a complete patchwork of, you know, dry and wet counties, that kind of thing. I think this issue of the revenues is interesting because some of the municipal and county entities have said that they're going to have increased expenses to enforce the rules. Others have said we shouldn't because you'll be arresting fewer people for pot, so you have resources you can move to the other. But if the whole system is put together in such a way that it actually works, there will be revenues. Making revenues available to people who need them is a good idea. It's a good way to, resolve some of those problems.
Well, there's what happens at the beginning and what happens as time goes on. And so most folks who have looked at some of the promises of, huge revenues right away from pot have said, we need to tamper that down. It's not going to be what you thought at the beginning. Because don't forget, there's this huge regulatory structure that has to come into play and set up and monitor. They're monitoring pot from seed to sale, which is going to be a lot of regulation. But as time goes on, and as the recreational pot, tamps down the illegal pot, then you can get more revenue and less law enforcement needs. It's going to take a while.
We mentioned this last week, but it's interesting enough that I think we should
mention. Clearly, I missed some things last week.
Trying to catch you up.
I appreciate it.
What is being proposed by a Republican legislator in terms of sending tax revenue generated in a certain geographic area directly back to that geographic area rather than spreading it around the state is exactly what Republicans generally oppose in terms of revenue that is spread around the state for infrastructure spending. So it would be great from the perspective of a lot of people in Seattle if this same philosophy would extend to, say, metro funding.
Interesting. Yeah, it could get very confusing. I was also wondering, I haven't found very much about it. I know it's been discussed. What happens to people who are in prison for marijuana convictions in
it's
Washington?
It's not retroactive.
State?
It's not retroactive, but...
So somebody sitting in prison for being a marijuana dealer is going to look out and see the state is now engaged in what that person was engaged in before. Skip, you looked at what was happening with the SPD and the way a police chief can do their work and pick their command staff. The city council has made a change?
Yeah, the city council this week voted unanimously to upend a 1978 law ordinance that basically the gist of it was that the chief could only hire his own command staff from within the department. I talked to Tim Burgess, president of the city council and one of the chief police reform guys. And he said they still haven't been able to figure out exactly how that law got passed or why. It hasn't been challenged before, as that I know of. But they threw that law out. And what is interesting to me is what's going on here is not just a search for a new chief. It's making changes to the department so that a new chief can be effective in the way the reformers want them to be effective.
You know, it seems that this mayor and the city council are very mindful that the last time they went searching for a police chief, they didn't receive that many great candidates. And so they're really trying to boost the applicant pool with a variety of different steps, you know, taking the interim chief, Jim Pugel, and making him, if he's going to be a candidate, he can't be the interim chief. This step that you're describing, which makes it sort of more likely that other chiefs would want to come with their team. People like to do that.
What's interesting is that the interim team led by Harry Bailey is not exactly, in the eyes of a lot of people, a reform team. Harry Bailey is very strongly aligned and a product of the police union, I believe, which is generally not pushing for reform in, say, the way a Jim Pugel is. And so, okay, the council has created a possibility that Harry Bailey and his current lieutenants in the leadership structure could all be replaced. We'll have a new chief and he'll clean house and get rid of all the other people who are at the top of the power structure. But there's also a possibility that that wouldn't happen. And then you don't end up with a lot of forward motion. And so I think that the council has created a possibility here, but the current leadership structure seems a little bit more about the status quo. And so I think it will be important to focus on that needing to be part of the change, that the change that Ed Murray has created in the department really has to be temporary because it is not actually the type of systemic change that he is paying lip service to wanting to see.
I think the council, for the most part, is on board with that. They understand that that's a kind of placeholder. One of the interesting things is the number of, I mean, they talking with Burgess, talking with Ann Levinson, who's the auditor of the Police Accountability Office. They have some very specific reforms that they'd like to see, and some of them, one of them has to do, and we've talked about this a little bit before, is getting the department much more technologically savvy. And one of the things that this throwing this rule out will do will allow the new chief to hire people based not on seniority, but based on skills. I mean, he could actually have someone in, you know, at the command level who's a, you know, police technologist. The other thing that's interesting is there's going to be a price tag with police reform. I mean, we've already spent a lot of money just on the whole process with the federal government and getting consultants and oversight and all that kind of thing, but the department's going to have to make an investment in computer equipment, software. One of the things they want to do, too, is look at how to get the many more of the people in the department on the streets doing policing and out of the office, perhaps replacing work that officers now do with civilians doing that work, office work. They're really going to have to take on the union. I mean, they're really, you know, to get the kinds of systemic changes in house cleaning that they want to have, they're going to have to go up again. And by they, I mean the mayor and the council. They're going to have to deal with the union at some level and getting some of the rules changed so that they can do this stuff.
And as you say, there's a new person who's going to be in charge of that union sometime soon.
Right. And it's worth keeping in mind as we keep a close eye on all of this that the police union endorsed Ed Murray, which was a big deal for Murray, which, you know, you could sit and speculate is one of the reasons we have a union leader at the head of the department now.
That was Eli Sanders, also Knut Berger, Joni Balter. We're talking about the week in review on KUOW Seattle from KUOW Seattle. You know, you can write us and tell us what you think. weekinreview@kuow.org. Like to get your emails, like to read them on the air. weekinreview@kuow.org. Earlier we were talking about Bertha. Shelley wrote, I've always loved this get-together you guys do, but this morning talking about Bertha, you sound like those cranky old guys down at the corner store over coffee. How about some real facts? Boom.
What are the real facts that you missed?
She'll have to tell us. All right, we're going to return to the Seahawks to end the show. Luke Burbank, who is host of Live Wire, host of his own podcast, Too Beautiful to Live, host of so many things that he is a minor celebrity in this town, or perhaps a major celebrity. You'll have to tell us, Luke. So you got to go see the game with the other major celebrities.
Yeah, I did actually manage to weasel my way into the NFC Championship game, but I had to wear this lucky Seahawks sweater that I've been talking about each week.
Uh-huh.
And then because this thing was sponsored by the search engine Bing, they gave me a hat, which I think I was legally obligated to wear in trade for getting to be in their suite. And the hat and sweater, I saw all these pictures on Facebook, which indicated to me I look exactly like the South Park character Eric Cartman now. And it's just a tough way to learn that you look like Eric Cartman is via social media. Other than that, it was a heck of a game.
Use a mirror, though. You know.
Whatever. I do what I want.
That's right. Respect my authority. Like I said, that's really more about me. The game itself was incredible. I really felt like that was kind of Seattle's Super Bowl.
Really?
Nobody left after the game for a good 45 minutes. I mean, there was this whole presentation of the trophy for winning the NFC. But there was just this feeling in the stadium that, I mean, I don't know how I divined this, but the sense I had was, if we win the Super Bowl, great. If we don't win the Super Bowl, we'll live. But beating San Francisco in that game in Seattle, it felt, I think, for that crowd, like we did it. We accomplished the main thing we wanted to accomplish, and now the Super Bowl is sort of gravy.
You went down on the field, right?
Yeah, I did. By the way, interesting note, the Seahawks have the most inappropriate warm-up music you've ever heard.
Which is?
It's NWA. It's all manner of rap, with including bad words. I don't think it's like supposed to be for the crowd in general. They have these giant speakers they roll out that are just playing onto the field. But it's awesome and really uncalled for.
Did you run into Marshawn Lynch and Richard Sherman's mothers?
I ran into Earl Thomas's mom and Richard Sherman's mom, and I. Well, what happened was Richard Sherman was fielding. They were warming up, and he had this, you know, kind of practice pass thrown to him, and he dropped it. And I kind of jokingly said, you know, Richard, get it together, to try to make my friends laugh. And then this very nice lady turns around. She goes, "Oh, did he drop the pass?" And I said, "Oh yeah." And I look, and I realize she's wearing a number 25 jersey. The back of the jersey says "Mom," and I realized, oh, this is Richard Sherman's mom. So then I was like,
so this explains everything. This explains the after the game rant. Everything.
Yes, precisely. I mean, a lot of people, and what's going underreported, Joni, is that Richard Sherman's anger was because you were making fun of him to his mom.
I had hurt
his mom's feelings before the game, but hey, it fueled him, and so I take a certain amount of responsibility for us winning the game.
Yeah, thank you for that. Now, who else was who are the other celebrities that were showing up at these boxes?
Well, the funny thing was, I had a little list of people I could invite. So the people I brought to the game were Dan Savage and his husband Terry, and then Ken Jennings, the Jeopardy expert. So there's this photo where Dan Savage retweets of me and Ken Jennings freaking out about the fact that we won. And I think the title was something like, "This is what it looks like when straights cry." it was a motley crew there in the box. But it was really fun. Now, I think also the evolution of the Richard Sherman story this week has been fascinating from kind of a media standpoint. Because right after the game, it was, this guy is conceited, he's a thug. And then Richard Sherman did a press conference this week where he said, "I don't like people using the word thug because that's just now code. It's the acceptable way to use the N-word when you're talking about an African-American man." And that sparked a whole, I thought, really interesting conversation about when we use thug, why we use thug. And now I'm seeing lots of people here towards the end of this week writing about how Richard Sherman is a thoughtful guy, how he's inarguably the best at his position. So the way this story has evolved, I think, is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it has been fascinating. I agree. You're going to watch the game from where?
I think I'm going to be in Seattle. There was a moment yesterday where I thought I was going to be able to weasel a trip out to New Jersey. By the way, how is the word weasel?
Just observing.
Okay, thank you. That probably indicates something, doesn't it, Joni? By the way, how sad are you if you're New Jersey and when the Seahawks win, they start playing New York, New York on the PA system in CenturyLink Field? I thought I was going to manage to finagle my way out to New Jersey, but I don't think that's going to happen. But actually, you know, I was at the Super Bowl in Detroit when the Seahawks went. I was covering it for NPR. And it's so much more fun to watch the Super Bowl in Seattle with your friends and family than to be at the location, is my experience with the one time they've been.
Cold too, right?
Because it was indoors. The thing that was bad about the Detroit game was that that's 5 hours from Pittsburgh, so it was basically a home game for the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Right. There you go.
And it was no fun to be there as a plus. I was in the press box, so I was trying to be really professional and represent NPR properly, but I have like a single tear running down my face as the Seahawks are frittering away the game.
Those calls were tough. They were tough.
Those were bad calls.
All right, give me one highlight from LiveWire tonight at 8 on KUOW.
That's a great question, Steve. We're running some encore editions. I think this might be the show where I talk about my plan to secretly buy a boat behind my wife's back, which is not a good idea, it turns out. And as my therapist instructed me. And I think that's one of the things we're going to talk about tonight. So it'll be an eventful hour of radio, 8 o'clock tonight on KUOW.
All right, Luke, good talking to you again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Luke Burbank keeps his finger on the pulse of Seattle culture. Him and Dan Savage together at the Super Bowl. And he's the host of LiveWire, which is on tonight, 8 o'clock. Shows up on Wait, Don't Tell Me. I'm not going to do his whole resume. Just not going to. Skip, should I do your whole resume, or should I just say author of Pugetopolis?
That's good.
All right. Eli, Pulitzer Prize winner. That's the top of your resume. I like that one. Do you want anything else?
I'll take that.
All right. What would you like?
I'll go with news analyst.
All right. And I'm Steve Scherer. I work at this radio station. We'll talk to you again next week.